This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a federal judge says the Pennsylvania prison system acted unconstitutionally in withholding medical care from Mumia Abu-Jamal, but he's still being denied treatment for hepatitis C. And the Green Party's Jill Stein challenges Trump and Clinton to open up the televised debate to third parties.
But first, it's been 20 years since President Bill Clinton and the U.S. Congress destroyed welfare as we knew it, the Aid for Families with Dependent Children program. We spoke with Maureen Taylor, chairperson of the Michigan Welfare Rights Organization.
Well, the biggest impact on William Jefferson Clinton's cave-in to manage something called welfare reform is that the number of people that are immersed in poverty across the nation has grown, has increased significantly. And so that's an issue. Of course, in Michigan, most salient here is the fact that now welfare recipients are only eligible to receive cash assistance for a period of 60 months, you know, 5 years, 60 months, over the lifetime of that individual. So if a person 10, 12 years ago ended up on welfare for 3 or 4 years after that, received welfare assistance while they improved their educational outlook and went, took some classes and took some training or whatever it is that they did, and then they got off welfare, in the next 5, 6, 7 years, they worked at a job, and then they got laid off. That would mean that they would only be eligible for cash assistance for another year. They could never again go to receive welfare assistance because of that rule. We're in a depression, some of the worst economic situations that the country has seen since 1929, and we have something called welfare reform that is the hangman for millions of welfare families, welfare children, blue-eyed, blonde kids across the country, and that is an absolute outrage.
Yes, AFDC was replaced by something they call temporary aid for needy families, and that aid has become quite temporary indeed. In fact, in some states, they want to cut it back to just 1 year.
Well, we're not talking about TANF like it used to be. That's the temporary aid for needy families. They call it around here DANF, D-A-N, disappearing aid for needy families. And I think it's going to change again and into disappeared aid for needy families. So the whole concept of the nation turning not against poverty, but trying to turn people against poor folks has been wildly successful by this ongoing media blitz that indicates that low-income or welfare recipients are just pulling the nation down, and these fat black women and these fat Hispanic women and these fat Native American women and these fat Appalachian women, you know, they're always fat. You know, they're just destroying the economy, and a lot of them may end up being immigrants. And, you know, immigrants show up and right away they cross the border and they go to the nearest welfare office. And that's why the country's in the downward spiral that it's in. So, you know, there's a corporate atmosphere in terms of trying to convince people across the nation, certainly across the world, that the problems that we're having in this country really are because, or at least one of them is because, we have these low-income people that pull down the quality of life for everybody else because we won't work, we won't do right, you know, we keep having all these babies, you know, 14 men and 27 children, the math doesn't even work right, you know, just all of this. And so there are multiple areas that we are experiencing during this 20-year celebration, if you will, of welfare reform, but all of the quote-unquote annotations and celebrations, they're all about a loss of civility, they're all about a loss of the capacity to live and quality of life and standard of living is under absolute attack by welfare reform. It was not good, and it continues to hurt and maim people.
And as you pointed out, it's gone beyond just the attacks on welfare as we knew it, but to food stamps as well.
I saw a message just this morning about food stamps cannot be denied to persons who have been convicted of a felony and have served their time. And these states know it, and these welfare offices know it, and know it. But yet there are thousands of people across the state of Michigan, you know, probably more than thousands, that are being denied food stamps based on some message that they can't eat if you've been convicted of a felony after you've served your time. It's just draconian. It's just monstrous. And these are all orchestrated attacks against low-income people.
And yet we see no major attempts within either major party to correct this historical wrong that was committed 20 years ago.
We've got a lot of historical wrongs in the United States of America that are documented on cowboy programs every day, on historical programs every day. Channel 247 and Channel 50 are movies every day that are not being championed, are not being researched, are not being exposed. And I'm afraid that the welfare reform known to the rest of us as deform is on that list. It's like a hidden agenda. We're just not going to talk about it, you know. And after all, poor people may not be that poor because most of them have refrigerators. And so that's how you can tell, you know, just... It's just unconscionable what goes on in the United States of America.
And we used to have welfare rights organizations in cities across the nation and a vibrant and very active national welfare rights organization. Except for you guys in Michigan, that scene is almost entirely deserted.
Well, we have at its height, we had a welfare rights collaborative or welfare rights affiliate in 38 states across the country. And with workfare and JET programs, jobs, education, and training, and all these government interventions that threaten people, if you don't go and do this, you won't get your food stamps. If you don't go and sign up for a job that pays less than minimum wage, we're going to cut off your Section 8 certificate, and all of these threats that continue to go on. One by one, the welfare rights organizations across the nation began to lose members. They just couldn't keep up. And so many of them just disintegrated into homelessness, and, you know, mental health issues began to take over. People just couldn't keep up, couldn't keep their families. We had suicides. It was just a mess, and it hasn't ended. We still have a very vibrant welfare rights organization, certainly statewide in Michigan. We have one that's quite active in New Orleans, even though they, you know, drowned the building out twice now. We had a pretty good one down in Miami, Florida, but, you know, they've lost ground, and they, you know, got a call a couple days ago. They're out now because their place is flooded out, and nobody's going to offer them anything new. And the one in Washington, D.C. is just barely hanging on. So we've got, you know, members of the organization still scattered across the country, but the organizational structure that we've known for so long, you know, a lot of that was just destroyed, certainly after welfare reform rules went into effect.
Hillary Clinton, of course, was the co-president back in 1996. She backed the abolition of welfare as we knew it. Mm-hmm. Her husband still does, and she has never recanted that position either.
Well, matter of fact, in a couple of days, the third party candidate, Jill Stein, and Mr. Barack, who will be in Detroit, to talk about some of the issues that are salient and germane and of interest to the lives of working people. And the person that you mentioned, including the other candidate, I've had to comment on this many, many times. Just came back a couple of weeks ago from the World Social Forum in Montreal. And everybody in Canada everybody who attended from the Netherlands, from Italy, from Germany, from Sweden, from Africa, from South America, and every place else that anybody attended this, they all asked the same question. How did you all in America end up with these two candidates? And the answer is the same. There are 337, 339 million people that live in the United States of America. Does anybody think that we, regular people, would have picked these two candidates? No, we didn't. These are corporate candidates. And the notion about, you know, who we're going to pick, the lesser of two evils, you know, that's not supposed to be the recollection that we stand on why people fought and died to be able to vote. It wasn't so we could get to, let's pick the lesser of two evils. That's what I'm saying. The atmosphere is just toxic in terms of voting, in terms of selection. People just don't have the same connection to voting because it appears as if the corporate class has declared war on working people and have said, thank you for your interest, but we're going to play like emergency managers and we're going to tell you the two candidates that you could choose from, this one or that one. These are not our candidates. They're not.
What kind of policies should social movements be pushing to guarantee that folks have a standard of living that has dignity?
Well, when you use the right word, when you talk about standard, when you talk about quality, what are the litmus tests that should be reviewed? You know, public officials, elected officials, way back from Egyptian folklore, their job is to protect the least. So that's supposed to be their job. Their job is not supposed to be to find a way to keep being elected so that they can keep getting paid. That's not their job. They've lost their way. You know, I forgot who it was that was running through the forest on the way to grandma's house. But the same story. You know, they've lost their way. What should happen is not rocket scientists. The nature of this country is supposed to be those lies that are written in those civics books. And that is a quality of life guaranteed to those people who live here. They didn't say residents, didn't say citizens, they didn't say duly elected. The people who live in this country are supposed to be guaranteed life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And there are very few things that are on that list. We need to be able to eat. We need to be able to have a roof over your head. You need to be able to have access to education so that our society can improve and our families and our children do better than we did. You need to be able to be guaranteed on safety. We need health so that if you get sick, you shouldn't have to prove that you have health insurance or else you'll die. They're very simple things. And the easiest way to come up with what should be done is to let's talk about the richest people in this country. What do they have? And why should we not, everybody, have what they have? I mean, Mr. Spock, James Kirk, you know, from Star Trek, had that brilliant discussion that day. And James Kirk is lamenting over the fact that Mr. Spock is about to die. And Mr. Spock reminds him, you know, Jim, you have been and always will be my friend, but you need to always remember that the needs of the many must always outweigh the needs of the few. That's not a hard concept. When I heard that years ago, I didn't have to watch Star Trek or anything else anymore, because that's the mantra that we should live by. Take care of each other, and the folks that have the least, none of that Bible quoting, the poor will always be with us. That's not what that slogan says. It says in the Bible, the poor will always be with us. And the next part says, because you people are too greedy to make certain that the stuff that you have, you share. That's what it says. So that's the issue. The needs of the many must always outweigh the needs of the few. Why is that hard to do? It's not.
That was Maureen Taylor of the Michigan Welfare Rights Organization speaking from Detroit, Michigan.
A federal judge cited a technicality to deny Mumia Abu-Jamal's demand that he and thousands of other Pennsylvania prison inmates suffering from hepatitis C be given medical treatment. The judge agreed that the system's failure to treat Mumia for this curable disease was unconstitutional, but claimed the legal action brought by Mumia's lawyers was faulty. Noelle Hanrahan is director of Prison Radio and works closely with Abu-Jamal. She says the judge is talking out of both sides of his mouth.
Judge Mariani found that the protocol that the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections uses to treat inmates for hepatitis C is unconstitutionally and meets the deliberate indifference standard. He even said that had Mumia Abu-Jamal sued the correct parties, he would have likely prevailed. And what he meant by correct parties is he said that, on a technicality, that the Hepatitis C Care Committee, a committee that was only established in November of 2015, just before our preliminary injunction hearing, that committee should have been named plaintiff. Now, it's also, I think, wrong, and he made an error, because certainly the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections and the number of people who were named in the case had the ultimate authority of making those decisions. They constructed the committee. They approved the committee's recommendations. This was a subcommittee. Now, the other point is Dr. Paul Noel, the head of the Correctional Medical Center, a motion was put forth to include him, and that was on Mariani's desk at the time that he did this. So I think it's a pretty disingenuous decision to limit Mumia Abu-Jamal's access to immediate life-saving care while crying, in the opinion, about the fact that it was deliberately indifferent and would not meet a constitutional standard. I mean, Mumia is one man, but there are 5,000-6,000 men and women suffering from chronic active hepatitis C. Many of them are dying. They're treating a handful. This protocol is like Mengele. You can't underestimate the level of depravity, the level of pure evil, really. You're having men and women in every single Pennsylvania prison in the infirmary in isolation in what they call hepatitis C care clinics, dying of a completely curable disease. There are death certificates that say hepatitis C on them, and there are many of them, hundreds of them.
In terms of the ruling, the committee that the judge referred to is actually a creature of the Department of Corrections, isn't it?
I think they established it to provide cover. They had to say that they were treating some people. So when they came to court for the preliminary injunction, the first time that they had been to court, the first time that Dr. Paul Noel had ever been on a witness stand, and he had worked for the Department of Corrections for years, they had to answer with cross-examination from Brett Grody and Bob Boyle. They had to say how many people they were treating. They tried to keep their hepatitis C protocol, which the judge just declared illegal, secret. They wanted it under seal, but we wouldn't let them. So I think the aggressive cross-examination really revealed how few people are being treated and the level at which it reminded me of reading Harriet Washington's Medical Apartheid. You can't construct a situation that is more grossly inhumane. We're talking about a public health imperative. It's like polio being cured. They found a cure in 2013, 99-95% cure. This is the most infectious disease in America. Over 3 million people have it. It's infectious for 20 years, mostly before people know that they're infected because your symptoms are delayed. So you have this incredible opportunity, and the only thing standing in the way of it are institutions, public institutions that have private contractors providing medical care, and probably the pharmacy companies that are extracting a huge price for it. Other countries have made deals with pharmacy companies that can be done. So we have an amazing opportunity to cure this public health crisis. It affects 1 in 7 African American men. This is a killer. So we have to do something about it.
And not just an opportunity, but a responsibility. These people are confined by the state, and the state is obligated to take care of their health. And they know that they are sick, and they know how to cure them.
The standard of care is medically indicated care, and without deliberate indifference. Well, what's more deliberately indifferent than watching people handcuffed to a gurney in solitary dying? You know, that is beyond the pale, and I think the judge recognized this. This was a victory of the facts coming forward, and yet again, they have taken this victory away from Mumia. He's suffering. Mumia Abu-Jamal has a 63% chance of advanced cirrhosis. He had an extraordinary attack on his organ, the skin, that put him in the ICU with renal failure. He was minutes from death. We are going to advocate that he gets the cure. We're going to win. This prospect of delay is very distressing. It's deeply disturbing. You know, when you wake up in the morning and you know that you live in America, you're really screwed. And that is just how it is. But we have to keep our eyes open. We have to keep our eyes on the prize, freedom, and we have to make sure that it happens. So I would advocate whatever people can do, if you give a gift or you take action, it matters.
Well, how long a delay are we talking about? If it's just a technical fix, how long does that take legally?
It takes an extraordinarily long time for justice to be done in America, and it only happens when the people demand it. It's 50% having great lawyers and 50% public sentiment and public opinion and the rising up and the calling for justice. Things change when people demand that they change, period. So how long has it taken? Mumia has had very good criminal conviction, evidence of innocence, and he's been in for 34 years. So, I mean, it could be decades. I mean, Mumia does not have a lot of time.
I'm speaking about the technical fix, the fixing what the judge called a technical flaw in the legal action.
The courts will move as fast or slow as they determine the public will take. And therefore, I believe that they are going to move as slow as possible. They will create delay after delay after delay. The more delay there is, the more correct care solutions, ka-ching, 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 makes money on not treating people. You'd think, oh, it'd be more cost-efficient to treat them. No, if they let them die, it's more cost-efficient. Correct care solutions and the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections are going to try and delay. The only thing that's going to change that is actions by people. The courts will not move more quickly unless there is a changing standard of what people consider decent. So unless there's an echo, a call, a demand, power concedes nothing.
But we do assume that the lawyers have moved to change the complaint to conform with the judge's ruling.
There's a lot of avenues available. And so they're thinking of amending, appealing, refiling. There are many avenues. Not sure which one is the quickest, but they're taking it all under consideration. There is an opportunity to fix this ruling, to correct its defect, but it will be debated. You know, it took us a year to get this preliminary injunction to where it is. So it's a difficult prospect. We are looking at time we don't have.
Prison radio director Noelle Hanrahan. Mumia Abu-Jamal took the decision in stride.
So it's a beginning, and it's a good beginning, that a federal judge recognizes that what the Commonwealth is doing and has been doing for years is not only unjust, but not right, unconstitutional, a violation of fundamental fairness and the human right to life. So it's a beginning. It's a good beginning, and we want a good ending.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner.
If Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton think they are really the preferred choices of the American people, they should allow the two smaller parties to take part in the televised debates that began on September 26. So says Kevin Zees, senior advisor to the Green Party's Jill Stein, a Jammu Baraka presidential ticket. After all, what kind of debate is it if the Greens and Libertarians are left out?
Yeah, that's a very big challenge, and we have a campaign going on both outside the Stein campaign and inside the outside campaign, which people can sign up for. You can go to Facebook, campaign for open debates, and like it and stay involved. We're starting to plan on-the-ground activities. We also are planning social media activities to push the candidates and the commission and the media. to open the debates to four candidates. Our view is that if you have potential for 270 electoral college votes, if you're on enough ballots to achieve that, then you should be in the debate. If you're on people's ballots, on voters' ballots, they should know what you stand for. They should see you debate the other candidates. And that 270, be on enough ballots for 270 electoral votes is not an easy task. The two parties have created incredible hurdles to get on the ballot in enough states for that. And by doing that, both the Johnson and Stein campaigns have shown that they have broad support in the public to be candidates and therefore should be included. There's just a poll out today that showed that half the public wants them included. The public wants it. And I don't see why the two other candidates, Clinton and Trump, would oppose it. It's a cowardly act, an anti-democratic act on their part. You know, in fact, Donald Trump in 2000, in a press conference with Jesse Ventura, expressed amazement that the so-called Commission on Presidential Debates could exclude candidates, that they had that power. He thought that was just amazing. He threatened to sue them. At the time, Pat Buchanan was suing them, so he was going to wait for that result. But he strongly came out against keeping candidates out of debates. We hope that Donald Trump sees that he should be consistent and say he opposes keeping Stein and Johnson out of debates. And that would be, he has the power.
Well, certainly he has the power. The debates are run, they're owned jointly by the Republican Party and the Democratic Party.
Exactly. The Republican Party and Democratic Party created a commission, kicked the League of Women Voters out, and said that we're running a show, and that commission was just a disguise for a corporation run by the Democrats and Republicans. That's how it still is. It's a disgrace to democracy that they can choose which candidates they will debate. And Donald Trump should be saying those D.C. elites are manipulating democracy. It's a populist position to have a real democracy and tie Hillary Clinton to these elites in D.C. who want to keep voters from hearing all their choices.
Now, one of the stipulations that the Republican-Democrat controllers of the debates make is that a candidate must register 15% in the polls. But I know that the CBS New York Times poll didn't even include Jill Stein's name in its polling methodology, although it did include the Libertarian candidate. And I'm talking about until deep into August.
That's a fraudulent standard that's created by the two parties in order to keep other candidates out. They recall what happened when Jesse Ventura ran for governor. He was at 10% in the polls. Then he got into the debates and won the election. There were a series of about six debates, and he won the election. So 10% was too low for them because Jesse Ventura overcame that. 15% is a very, very difficult standard for a third-party candidate to get because they don't get covered in the media. They don't have the money from the corporations to advertise in the media. And so it's an impossible standard to meet. It's designed to be impossible. Unless you're a billionaire candidate, part of the oligarchy, who can afford to run advertisements like Ross Perot did, there's no chance of really getting in the debates for any independent challenger, even though today half the voters in the United States are independent of the two parties. So we're not represented in these debates, and I think that's a disgrace to democracy as well. So we don't think there should be any 15% standard. If being on enough ballots to get 270 electoral college votes is enough of a standard, enough of a show of broad support that you should be included in debates, and those debates will decide whether or not you will achieve enough votes from the people. But people have to see you. Those debates, you're talking about, you know, 50 million to 70 million people watching. And Gary Johnson just said the other day, if he's not in the debates, he's finished. That's how important they are. If it's just Trump and Clinton, will be, first off, a really boring debate. Each one will call each other names, and no one will put forward any policies that are outside the very narrow acceptable limits of the two corporate parties. If we have a broader debate with Johnson and Stein, then you'll have a real debate. You'll really have an impact on the political agenda in the United States, not just the electoral vote, but also what's discussed, what's included in politics. Neither Trump or Clinton support single-payer health care, even though 60% of Americans support it. Stein would be out advocating for that. Neither Trump or Clinton support a $15 living wage. Neither does Johnson. Stein supports that. On issue after issue, you'll see that Stein especially will broaden the debate and change the political agenda, and that's really what these debates are about. In addition to these campaigns, they're about really what we can debate in this country, what is on the political agenda. By the way, I'd love to see a Jamu Baraka debating those other three vice presidential candidates. He would definitely bring a different perspective, and these milquetoast vice presidential candidates would be ashamed after that debate because Obama would wipe them up.
What the polls do show is that at least half of the American public dislikes both candidates, and so would certainly theoretically be open to entertaining other candidates if they knew they existed.
That's right. Very high percentages. The majority in Trump's case, a near majority in Clinton's case, of voters who say they support them because they don't like the other candidate. They don't support them because they like Clinton or like Trump. They dislike the other candidate, and that's why they're supporting them. And then these are the two most unpopular candidates in U.S. history, based on polls. There's never been two candidates as unpopular as Trump and Clinton. And it's coming a time when, for the first time ever, a plurality, maybe even a majority of Americans now are independent of the two parties. So we have a very different situation. I think opening the debates up would be an incredible opportunity for surprises, even more surprises, and a very surprising election year already, with Trump dividing the Republican Party and Clinton really dividing the Democratic Party in a battle of Sanders. And so there's a lot of divisions in those two parties. And so allowing Johnson and Stein to debate would be a great benefit to the political discourse.
President Obama has launched his last big push for his Trans-Pacific Partnership corporate trade deal. Right. Hillary Clinton says she's not for TPP, but nobody believes her.
Now, this is a critical issue and a critical moment. I think, first of all, I got to explain, under Fast Track, President Obama decides when this issue is debated, when it's resolved. He starts the clock. As much as Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell have said that there are not enough votes to pass it, and they would not bring it to a vote, it's not really up to them. There's one shot on the Fast Track for a vote on the TPP, and it's up to Obama when that happens. So he may imagine that he starts the clock at the lame duck, forces them to take a position, yes or no, and if they refuse or vote no, the TPP cannot be brought back up again for ratification. So this is critical. The key is, the only way we win is if Obama is convinced not to bring it to a vote. There's only two ways to accomplish that. One, the people have to really be strong, and we're doing a protest next Tuesday at 11 o'clock, one at the Senate and another one at the House, putting them on notice that if they bring this to ratification, there will be mass opposition. We've got 4,000 people signed up already. We'll have more by the time of the lame duck, signed up already to be part of an effort to disrupt in any way possible the passage of the TPP. Jill Stein and Ajamu Barak, Ajamu is actually even part of our protest. Jill recognizes that the power comes from the people at the bottom and is urging people to get involved in stopping the TPP. Another way to do that is Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton is now the leader of the Democratic Party. She used to say the TPP was the gold standard. Now she says she doesn't support it. She can show the people that she's telling the truth by publicly telling all of her superdelegates who made sure she became the nominee. These superdelegates make up every Democrat elected in Congress, among others. If she tells the superdelegates in public and demands that they come out now and say they will vote against ratification, then Obama will see he does not have the votes and will not bring it to a vote. He'll let Hillary deal with it when she's president. So Hillary has the power to stop this. The people have the power, if they can convince their legislators to come out publicly and say, no, I won't vote for it, to stop it. It comes down to showing Obama that going the ratification route and the lame duck session will fail. If he's convinced of that, he'll punt to the next president and leave it to that to resolve this issue. Otherwise, it's going to be very tough. Will these corporate politicians, especially the Democratic Leadership Council-type Democrats and the Republicans, the big business Republicans, will they accept an agreement that's imperfect from their perspective, or will they let the agreement totally die? That's really what it comes down to. And that could be a bluff that Obama will call.
So if Hillary Clinton doesn't emphatically, foursquare, ask her supporters to oppose a vote being taken on TPP, you would take that as evidence that she's been lying all along about her opposition?
It would be evidence that she's not serious about opposing it. She knows the law. You know, she knows the reality, and I'm sure her and Obama have discussed it. And so she can say, I'm against it, and I'll be against it when I'm president. But if Obama passes it in a lame duck, that takes that hot potato off her plate. And so if she does not use all the power she has as the new leader of the Democratic Party to tell every Democrat to come out publicly and say they oppose it, that is a gift and a signal to President Obama to go forward. Remember, during the platform fight, Bernie Sanders put forward a plank that called for opposition to the TPP and called for no lame duck vote. Hillary Clinton did nothing to support that, and that plank was beaten back to a vague opposition to TPP, but leaving it up to individual members of Congress to decide what they want to do. So that's a big signal right there that they would not put in place a plank that said no vote during the lame duck. And so Hillary Clinton has already showed part of her hand that she's joking about opposing the TPP. She's fooling us about that. Now it's time for her to make up for that and actually say she opposes the TPP and she wants every Democrat who supported her to oppose it and to say so publicly so President Obama does not bring this to a vote.
Well, Hillary Clinton not only can send a big signal to Democrats, but to Republicans as well. After all, she's stuffed enough of them into her big tent campaign.
Man, oh man, she sure has. She has shown what a one-party state looks like because she has combined the Democrat and Republican parties in her campaign. And that's just one more reason why people should feel free to vote for Jill Stein and Jean-Luc Baraka, because now it's really clear we do have a one-party state and a one-party campaign. Donald Trump is way behind in the Electoral College potential votes. And so it's really a choice between a one-party corporate Clinton government, and people should really feel free that they are now have the ability to vote against corporate power. I mean, that is, after all, what this is about. The TPP is a question of people power versus corporate power, as are so many other issues that we're facing. And there's only one campaign of the four that are running that is against corporate power. Gary Johns, by the way, supports the TPP. Amazingly, he calls it free trade when it's really crony capitalist trade. Totally false description. I don't know if he understands what he's saying. He says, it makes no sense to me that a free trade person, someone who really believes in free trade, would support the TPP because it's not free trade. It's corporate rig trade. So Stein is the only one standing against corporate power and with the people. And so now we see the Clinton campaign becoming a Republican-Democrat campaign, and some of the worst Republicans, a lot of the neocons who want to see greater war, are joining her campaign. Now we see that. I think that frees people up to ignore this lesser evil voting and this fear-based voting to vote for what they really want and vote for Stein, Baraka. It's a new time. It's a different kind of election. It's not the same as what we've seen in the past when the two parties try to pretend they're different. Now we see the two parties getting under one tent and pushing the progressives who supported Sanders, you know, back to, as you said, I think you were so vivid, you said back to the latrine on the bus. I'm not usually as harsh as that, but since you said it, I can at least quote you to yourself. But people who now see that, I think, should wake up and realize they only have one ethical choice. If they really want to see the issue of people power versus corporate power, there's only one ethical choice, and that's to vote for Stein, Baraka, and do so with confidence. And then we need to keep working to challenge Hillary if she becomes the president and Stein and Baraka don't make it. Either way, that's the direction we have to go.
That was Kevin Zeese, senior advisor to the Green Party's presidential ticket.
Barack Obama is in the twilight of his presidency and paying lots of attention to how history will treat his 8 years in office. Danny Haifong has been doing a political audit of Obama's time in the White House. Haifong is a regular contributor to Black Agenda Report. This week, he authored his 9th article in a 10-part series on the Obama legacy. Haifong calls Obama the highest expression of counterinsurgency, referring to the counterinsurgency war waged against Black radicals by the U.S. government, beginning more than 40 years ago.
Exactly. The administration of Barack Obama was and still is the highest expression of the U.S. government's effort to neutralize the Black liberation movement, and we only need to examine his legacy over the last 8 years and the policy record that he has left behind to make this conclusion. If we just look at the disparity between the condition of Black America and the condition of working class people in general in the United States and the level of political development of the mass movement in this country, we see that it really wasn't until 2014, when Obama was in his last years, that any semblance of a movement against issues like police brutality and racism began to come back to the fore. And even in that movement, we haven't heard much about Barack Obama's role in, let's say, funneling in over $700 million worth of military weaponry to the local police departments from the Pentagon, or how his administration actively fought to ensure that thousands of black prisoners would remain behind bars without the enforcement of the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010. So really what we see with the Obama administration is the culmination, as you put it, of 40 years of first overt state repression of the Black Liberation Movement, and after its dissolution, the enforcement of a political regime that has been run by this new black misleadership class over the last generation or so, which has diluted, sanitized, and almost destroyed up until recently the black radical tradition as we knew it.
Yes, in the late 1960s, there were only hundreds of black elected officials. Today, we have well over 10,000, and yet black folks are not 10 or 20 times stronger politically than they were in the 1960s.
No, actually, the position, the class position of black people in general, but especially the black working class, is far worse than it was 40 years ago. The wealth gap between black America and white America is now larger than it was during the civil rights era. And that is mostly due to the fact that the U.S. capitalist system has been in crisis over that period and has deemed black labor virtually unnecessary to a new financialized, crisis-ridden order. But also it has to do with the political vacuum that was left after the destruction of the Black Liberation Movement, after it became disorganized and deorganized by the forces of the state. And that left the radical forces in this country unable to fight against these new conditions and able to build a movement against these new conditions that we faced over this last generation. And so that allowed these black elected officials, as well as the black faces in high places in all sectors of U.S. society, to dictate the politics of not just the black left, but also the left in general. Because what we've seen, especially in the Obama era, is a silence of the left, a virtual neutralization of the entire left around issues of endless warfare, around the looting of the working class by Wall Street, and around things like surveillance. It has been a very difficult period for the left to organize any sort of resistance to things that, when a Republican Party administration was in office during the Bush era, hundreds of thousands of people were out on the streets to protest things like war in Afghanistan, Iraq. And what we've seen since the Obama period has come to the foreground is the elimination of almost all resistance. And so it hasn't been up until his swan song, so to say, that we've seen any progress in the mass movement in general in this country. And that has to be examined. That's what I try to do in the Obama Legacy series.
How do you think history will treat Barack Obama?
Well, I think it depends on what side of the class spectrum you're on. For, I think, struggling people, working class people in the United States and around the world, especially Black America, there will be a struggle that will have to be waged in terms of what Obama's legacy will be, because we all know, especially listeners of this program, that once he leaves office, the corporate media, his Wall Street backers, the entire ruling class that he helped bring under the big tent that now Hillary Clinton occupies, will be attempting to paint his legacy in a light that is far more positive than it actually was for the rest of us. I think for us, history should paint Obama as the most effective evil, as Black Agenda Report has called him, that the ruling class could buy. The Republican Party under the Bush administration and administrations prior could never have instituted some of the things that Obama was able to get away with without any protests. And we saw that Obama was able to get away with for example, deporting the most immigrants out of any president in U.S. history, imprisoning the most whistleblowers at a rate higher than any president in U.S. history, closing more schools than any president in U.S. history, and facilitating the largest wealth transfer to the 1% from the rest of us in U.S. history. And these are things that he was able to get away with. And so we know that his legacy has been an ongoing process for the ruling class in sanitizing and painting Barack Obama as either the lesser of two evils, someone who has been a cold but reasonable politician who deserves our respect, or two, a politician that was really a victim of sabotage. And that's a popular argument that liberals make, is that he was a victim of Republican Party sabotage and racism, and that disallowed him from doing anything. But if we look at his record, we see he did plenty, and all of it was on the negative score column for us.
Hillary Clinton will certainly have no problem in November in retaining black voters, but will she be able to wear the kind of Teflon, especially in the black community, that protected Barack Obama from criticism for most of his 8 years?
And see, this is the key question, I think, because what we've seen, and this is something that I am going to tackle in part 10, what we've seen is Hillary Clinton having the same black misleadership class, the same marketing apparatus, maybe even more so in terms of just pure resources from Wall Street than Barack Obama. However, she is unable and unprepared to continue on his legacy. Her record is just that bleak. And I think one of the disadvantages that she has under her belt is that she has been at the forefront of the presidential stage already, and she has acquired a record that Barack Obama was able to much more effectively hide, whether he was called quote unquote a community organizer or his work in the Senate or whatever it was. He could hide behind that legacy, and she has not been able to do that. It's just not going to happen, because a lot of black people see Hillary Clinton as the facilitator of things like the destruction of welfare as we knew it, for increasing the mass incarceration regime through the various crime bills during the Clinton administration, the destruction of industrial jobs further with NAFTA that Bill Clinton put into place and signed into law. These are things that Hillary Clinton cannot run from, as Obama could hide behind much better with his more, I would call, stealth and covert record as someone who always worked for the ruling class, but someone who did it in a much more careful and covert way. So Hillary Clinton does not have that luxury, and as we see, her record has been publicized, and she's been attacked much more so. But I think it has a lot to also do with the fact that Barack Obama's rise was a part of an ongoing process of neutralization of the Black Liberation Movement, in that he had so many more resources behind him that have historically been built just for this moment of crisis management. Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, she's just another ruling class politician. And so she is garnering a lot more attention than Obama ever has. And while I'm happy that the left has awakened somewhat to what the ruling class is doing to all of us, I am also disheartened that the Obama and Clinton connection, it has not been made.
Although the black misleadership class's loyalty to the Democratic Party is unshakable, the Movement for Black Lives, used to be called Black Lives Matter, has avoided, after some dalliances, aligning itself with the Democrats and says it will operate independently.
Yes, and that has been a really positive development. And I think what I'm going to argue in the part 10 of the Obama Legacy series, the last installment, is that Barack Obama facilitated this. I think on the one hand, his administration has taken us so far back politically and materially, given how much ground the majority of people in the United States have lost. Most people cannot afford a $1,000 emergency, and that has a huge impact in its relation to the larger system that they live under. But these policies, the constant erosion, the persistent decline and stagnation, not just of the capitalist economy, but the parallel decline and stagnation of working class life in the United States has produced this moment where we see the right wing grassroots base of the Republican Party defect to Donald Trump, and we see a split in the Democratic Party that temporarily was able to huddle under Sanders until his betrayal. And now we see the Movement for Black Lives analyze these conditions and maintain independence in the face of enormous pressure from the Democratic Party establishment to not just eradicate its movement ideologically, but also to bring it under its tent, because the Democratic Party, as much as Hillary Clinton is courting the entire ruling class under its tent, it cannot survive or last in the same way without Black America's support, without labor's support, and without the support of its grassroots progressive base. It will not be the Democratic Party, which has occupied political space over the last 40 years, if the trend continues and if the Movement for Black Lives and other movement forces are able to continue its independence from the two-party corporate duopoly.
Danny Haifong, political activist and regular contributor to Black Agenda Report.
Anti-war activists are still angry over an article published in the magazine In These Times, attacking the anti-war movement for demanding that the U.S. get out of Syria. Sarah Founders, one of the leaders of UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition, was interviewed recently by Brendan Stone, a radio station CFMU in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Flounders says the magazine writer is trying to sow dissension in the movement.
Well, the very people who are raising it and trying to spread a great deal of confusion are really doing so to justify U.S. intervention, U.S. bombing, U.S. arming of Contra and thoroughly reactionary forces, and doing so through Saudi Arabia, through Turkey, through Israel. And how do you justify these wars? By saying, let's not pay attention to what U.S. imperialism is doing. Why, that's minor. We're speaking for the Syrian people. And the people that they claim to be speaking for are really an all but non-existent force. As in every war, there are two sides. One is, in this war, the government of Syria, where the U.S. is completely committed, as they say again and again, to regime change. That means the total overturn, the smashing of the Syrian state as it exists now, and the forces that the U.S. has armed and trained coming into power. And anyone who has any confusion as to where that leads has only to look at Libya or at Iraq today and see the howling wasteland that has been created. These were countries that previously had, by UN measure, by hundreds of organizations that have looked at these countries, they had full free health care, free education, electrification, potable water, had vastly increased the infrastructure. In other words, they had made real gains for the population. And what did U.S. bombing and destruction and arming of these Contra death squads do? And is to totally unravel the government and put nothing in its place. And while the U.S. bombs were targeting the very infrastructure, the roads, the hospitals, the electrification, the whole communications grid, these are what the U.S. targets. So we need to really talk about what U.S. wars do and who are the forces that they back, which are wholly reactionary, have no progressive content and no ability or interest in reorganizing society. Is war for Wall Street profit, no matter how you look at it.
I'm just wondering how you think the anti-war movement should address this conflict or future conflicts in which the U.S. supports internal destabilization and tells us that there's a revolution or something going on.
I think the most important way to do it is to consciously build unity and cooperation among all the forces who are determined to oppose U.S. wars, to come together on statements on actions which say, hands off Syria, U.S. out, and which try to also explain globally what these wars are doing and what these U.S.-created alliances are doing in looting whole parts of the world and creating the refugee crises. Now, we can't answer every possible voice that's put forward because that is the role of the corporate media. It is to pull people in with lies and to pull them in also with fear and demonization. So it becomes impossible to look at the country involved. Part of the thing when U.S. bombs fall, in the media they always claim that they're bombing Saddam Hussein or they're bombing Gaddafi or now they're bombing Assad. Of course, who they're really bombing is the entire population. But by focusing on one person, they take it off of that image for the U.S. population. They're trying to, by raising one evil boogeyman, so to speak, to take it off the attention of what happens when you're destroying the sanitation, the sewage, the electric grid of a country. And we want to always bring it back to that. These wars are against an entire country. They're meant to recolonize the world. They're intended to destroy what has been built up over generations. It's about regaining oil and pipelines and really that hole that existed 100 years ago.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.